First, we'll get you ready for, well, the coming fun of next Tuesday as Halloween approaches. A little something special for you here.
A dinner was served for three at Dracula's house by the sea. The hors d'oeuvres were fine, but I choked on my wine when I learned that the main course was me.
Ah, yes, the classic Dinner with Drac from John Zacherle, who hosted his own TV show featuring great old and some not so great old scary movies, part of the Shock Theater package that was released in the late 50s. And to talk more about that, we're joined by our friend, writer and critic, Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, how's it going?
Going very well, thank you. Shock Theater, 1957, over four dozen movies, pre-1948 horror films, released to local television stations, and man, it changed local television. It changed the lives of a lot of impressionable young people like ourselves.
I think in the spirit of this piece that I should be Sea Dog Frankston, your horror host. And I was thinking you could be RK, the Hunchback of Bangor, Maine. They attract scansion. But yes, exactly. That's what happened in 1957. The Universal Films pre-1948, so basically we're talking 1931, that's when Dracula came out, to 1948, kind of like the first cycle of those horror films of very varying quality. 52 of them went out to television stations across the country. The thinking being was, here is some cheap late-night filler for you, and you can put it on Friday night, Saturday night, when other people aren't really watching, and so you can have the block filled out with programming you would need what eventually became a horror host, someone who would maybe dress up in some grease paint and pop out of a coffin and do some shtick or whatever it might have been, and it went in all kinds of different directions, and it really introduced or reintroduced a lot of these films back into the culture, because you have to realize it wasn't like it is now when we can pop on Amazon or YouTube or whatever you want and pay $2.99 to watch some old film. It was very difficult to see some of these standbys back then, and an entire generation could have been completely unaware of them.
And some of these, I mean, there's some not very good movies in the mix, but some classics were in there too. Frankenstein, Dracula, The Mummy. There were some good movies.
Oh, there definitely were. Yeah, you have The Black Cat from 1934, which was directed by Edward Ulmer, Poverty Row director, who had kind of very artistic tendencies. He trended almost towards an American version of German Expressionism. In fact, he would tell these tall tales. They'd be like, oh, yeah, I worked with Fritz Lang. I definitely did this on, like, M, and I did this on Metropolis. And people looked it up later. It's like, kind of looks like you didn't, but whatever. He talked a nice game, and he certainly delivered on a film like that. And you had The Raven, which was Karloff and Lugosi together, and Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, another good one from 1943, which really was the first film that pitted archetypical monsters together. We see it all the time now with superhero films, where it's Batman and Superman, they're doing whatever together, and then the next film, they're enemies. That was really sort of what began with Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. It's also where when people conflate Frankenstein, the name, with Frankenstein, right, the monster, it really goes back to that film. These baby boomers watched this stuff, and it gained huge cultural cachet, and you would see horror films referenced all the time after this. If you've seen like the early episodes of Leave It to Beaver, they're always going off to like some horror film or talking about some horror film that they saw on what was basically the Shock Theater package.
And then a subsequent release included some of the Hammer films, the American International Pictures films, the Godzilla movies, and others made their way here. And you had that early group of hosts, the people like Zacherle, but then in later years on places like, I assume, the station you watched as a young man, which would have been Channel 56 in Boston, that had what became the Creature Double Feature.
Oh, yeah. Channel 56 was great. It seemed like, and I'm sure it wasn't the case, but when I was a kid, it seemed like there were two stations. There was Channel 56 because of Creature Double Feature, which you knew if you were a kid, like in the 80s. And then there was Channel 38, which you knew if you were a Bruins fan. And then also the Movie Loft was on Channel 38, which was this program.
Oh, Dana Hersey. Dana Hersey, I loved it.
Yeah, he like hung out in the loft. He found this abandoned warehouse by like the waterfront, right? And they go down to the harbor. It's like, yeah, we're going to show a movie. But the emphasis, again, even with that, was on kind of quickie, cheap television filler. And you might think now it's like, well, there are 900 stations and we want more. And back then there were a lot fewer. And this is really not even that long ago. But the thing about Creature Double Feature was it seemed like this bootleg program that had somehow made it on air. And I played hockey at the time, and if you have kids, and you know that youth hockey means you're getting up awfully early in the morning and driving somewhere, and you're coming back after the kid skates at like 6, and then you come back and like you have the whole morning. Like the Smurfs are just coming on, and you've been up for like 3 hours. So the Creature Double Feature would be on. And there was a Godzilla monster at the beginning of it for the opening credits, and this blaring soundtrack that it seemed like wasn't volume adjusted for your set, and there were these like day-glow trippy colors. So if you were a kid, that coupled with like your English muffin was your version of a contact high. It seemed mind-blowing at the time, and then you got these two, well, creature features, and they could be of wildly varying quality, like really they could be all over the place. But it introduced me to these films that I otherwise would not have seen, and though they might appear quaint now, they could be quite terrifying if you were a kid. And it felt like you were in on something, but in a very wholesome way that was illicit. And I like that transgressive aspect of it. For me, that was something that I felt later with like rock and roll or certain forms of literature or maybe art house films, but it was a gateway to all of that. And some of the stuff, to be honest with you too, at the same time, you watch like 1932's Murders in the Rue Morgue, like it's kind of about like people wanting to hump animals. It's like, oh my God, what the hell is this? Because it was a pre-code film, which basically means if you're not a cineast that there was no system of checks and balances. So long as you didn't swear or show nudity, you could do anything you want, any crime against nature, God, what have you, country, your fellow man. It was all fair game for the very early horror films in America, and I thought it was just the coolest thing ever.
And some of those movies that seemed to be fairly simple, the more you got into them, they really talked about some very interesting issues. And the one that I remember so vividly from a station around here, it must have aired The Incredible Shrinking Man about 24 times. And I think I watched it every time. And that was, yeah, you could accept it at face value, but it was an interesting parable about humanity as well. And you look back on it now, and it was quite a good movie.
Oh, it was. It really holds up. Some of them that were kind of like, think of how rudimentary, really, this isn't great for someone like me who's a hypochondriac right now, but how rudimentary medicine was in some ways not that long ago. And there was a great aspect of the unknown there. And the horror films of that early cycle certainly played off of that. You have like The Invisible Man, that's kind of another one that's in that sort of like horror medical genre. And people are wielding, it seemed like, an awful lot of scalpels in these things, and people are being shrunk down and inserted into things into which they should not be inserted into. It's this kind of rampant medico unnatural order, which has like links really in terms of the unnatural order back to Shakespeare. But now there's this scary 20th century aspect to it that, you know, it's like we're talking about a time when people also sometimes didn't believe in banks. They put like their money under their mattress. Same people wouldn't necessarily bring their kids to doctors. So this would have been kind of like another form of bogeyman while also dealing with the unknown with medical technology and scientific theory.
And do you think, too, Colin, that the showing of all these films in the 60s, 70s, and 80s led to the rise of the more contemporary films by people like John Carpenter, maybe Sam Raimi and folks like that?
Certainly Carpenter, yeah. If you think about something like, well, he remade Howard Hawks's, well, actually, the official director was Christian Nyby, who was an editor for Howard Hawks, but Howard Hawks probably did most of the work. The Thing from Another World, Carpenter remade that in 1982, and while that's not really in this cycle, Carpenter would have been well-versed in all this. And if you think of, like, his version of The Thing, there is such an emphasis on terror. And there's a big difference between terror and horror. And Boris Karloff would always object to being called a horror actor. He'd say, no, I'm in terror films. And if you think about it, horror is like what the fallout of something is. It's already occurred, and you're assessing the damage and what it's going to mean to your life. So horror, in a sense, is a sort of accounting where you're already beginning to do damage control and move forward. You know, no matter how bad the situation is, what the situation is. Terror, in other ways, is worse. Terror is the lead-up to the fallout. It's when you don't know what's going to happen, where your imagination encroaches upon you and makes you think that there is no limit to how bad this can be. And we see it in Shakespeare. You see it in Kafka. You see it in Hitchcock. You see it in some of these films that we're discussing. Terror is a rarefied, piquant, in some ways pleasing sensation, but it can also be among the worst sensations. So I think someone like Carpenter would have known that difference. You see that difference in something like Night of the Living Dead, which is a very sort of European film. It's drawing on those European traditions that a lot of the early American horrors are drawing on. It's not really this kind of zombie film that an extended series like The Walking Dead is. It's more about that notion of what's going to happen here. And that's why, at the beginning of Night of the Living Dead, if you remember, the brother is doing a Boris Karloff imitation with his sister when they're out in the cemetery. So I think it's a very on-the-nose and yet subtle at the same time kind of homage.
A warm place in my heart for so many of those movies. Sea Dog, the sun is going down. It's time for you to wake up.
I hear you, Punchback.
Thank you, Colin. We'll see you next week.
All right, take care.
That is Colin Fleming with us here on Dantan.